I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. President Obama ended his last State of the Union address on Tuesday night by declaring that, quote, the state of our union is strong. He didn't include a long list of what he wanted to accomplish this year, although he did remind the audience about his administration's accomplishments in energy and the environment, the economy, and health care. He did acknowledge that many don't feel financially secure, but didn't blame them for the problems that led to the recession and its fallout.
Food stamp recipients did not cause the financial crisis. Recklessness on Wall Street did. Immigrants aren't the principal reason wages haven't gone up. Those decisions are made in the boardrooms that all too often put quarterly earnings over long-term returns. It's sure not the average family watching tonight that avoids paying taxes through offshore accounts.
Critics have blamed Obama for global crises, including the rise of ISIS and the turmoil in the Middle East, saying the U.S. has been a weak player on the international stage. Here's how the president addressed those critics.
I told you earlier, all the talk of America's economic decline is political hot air. Well, so is all the rhetoric you hear about our enemies getting stronger and America getting weaker. Let me tell you something. The United States of America is the most powerful nation on earth. Period. Period. It's not even close. It's not even close. It's not even close. We spend more on our military than the next eight nations combined. Our troops are the finest fighting force in the history of the world.
And he ended by talking about the state of our politics, admitting that he did not fulfill a campaign promise to bring comity to Washington.
Our public life withers when only the most extreme voices get all the attention. And most of all, democracy breaks down when the average person feels their voice doesn't matter, that the system is rigged in favor of the rich or the powerful or some special interest.
Well, today on Radio Times, we are going to talk about what the president talked about last night and also talk a bit about what South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley said, the GOP response to the State of the Union address. And joining us here in our Philadelphia studios is Matt Kerbel. He's professor and chair of the Political Science Department at Villanova University. And nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Nice to be back.
I know you had to get through traffic to our audience or to our studios here. And joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. is Juana Summers. She's political editor at Mashable. And Juana Summers, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Juana, let me begin with you. Oftentimes, these State of the Unions follow a certain script. Anything new, unusual about what the president either did or said last night?
There is quite a bit that was unusual about this speech. The president, frankly, took the script for what we traditionally see in a State of the Union address, and he threw it out the window. You didn't hear him tick off that long list of all the things he hopes and dreams of doing in his final year in office. Frankly, getting significant legislative accomplishments through a Republican-controlled Congress will be very difficult for this president, particularly in a presidential election year. What instead you heard was him evoke a lot of emotion last evening. He talked a lot about his hopes and dreams for the country and worked hard to paint a contrast to some of the fear and anxiety that the nation has heard from Republicans on the campaign trail. It was a very non-traditional speech, as the White House had told reporters it would be in the weeks leading up to it, and I think really set the tone from what the kind of role we're likely to see Obama play as the 2016 race continues to unfold for the next few months.
Matt, does a non-traditional speech fit the times, you think, and also the fact that this is the last year for the president?
Well, I think it does, and if you take a look at the situation that the president faces. He knows that if he had offered a long laundry list of proposals, that most of them would be dead on arrival in Congress. And in a way, I felt he was almost liberated last night in the sense that he didn't have to do that. He's looking at his last year in office, and he's looking ahead. Instead of asking people to think about the next year, which is traditional for a State of the Union address, Obama asked people to look further ahead, really into the next presidential term or two. So one way to look at this speech, which which I agree with Juan, it was highly thematic, is as perhaps the first speech of the general election campaign upcoming, where President Obama really attempted to lay out in fairly broad themes what he'd like the framework for that election to be.
Well, let me go back to you, Juana. You had an interesting piece, and I'm just going to quote from it here. In delivering his final speech, it seems as though Obama has mastered another social subtlety, the subtweet. What is the subtweet, and how did he use it?
The subtweet, if you're a Twitter fan, you know what the subtweet is. You know that it's that art of delivering that finely tuned insult without even acknowledging the person you're insulting is in the room or even frankly exists. And that's a lot of what we heard from Obama last night. So much of his speech, what I heard, was really a rebuke of the themes of the 2016 campaign. You heard it when he countered, without naming him, some of Donald Trump's proposals, also those of Ted Cruz and Chris Christie. Obama sought to thematically paint his vision of the United States as somewhere where the economy is getting better, where people are getting jobs, where there's been progress made. And that sounds really, really different from what you hear on the Republican campaign trail and what we're likely to hear from Republicans debating tomorrow night in South Carolina. And I think that that's absolutely correct to say that this is the first speech of the general election campaign. Obama is stepping out into the 2016 fray and making a stark distinction between what his party stands for and what the Republican Party stands for.
Let me quote something from the president last night. He said, when politicians insult Muslims, when a mosque is vandalized or a kid bullied, that doesn't make us safer. That's not telling it like it is. It's just wrong. It diminishes us in the eyes of the world. It makes it harder to achieve our goals, and it betrays who we are as a country. Matt, was he talking about Donald Trump and some of the other Republican candidates for president?
Absolutely. And remember, this speech is now being offered in the context of roughly half a year in which Donald Trump and the Republican field has dominated the news. So what the president attempted to do last night is reach for a more optimistic note, a very progressive note. It was an extremely progressive speech. And he laid out a vision for the country that not only contrasts what Republicans have been talking about, but which really either Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders, I think, would feel quite comfortable running on.
Give us more details. Progressive how? In what way?
Well, in the sense that if you take a look at some of the points that the president made last night, in terms of economic inequality, for instance, in terms of some of the specific policies, although he spoke really more in generalities, but where he did talk about policies, he was talking about things that would help middle class people, things that really we've heard both major Democratic candidates talk about over the last few months.
Does he, though, want to bear some responsibility for the economic inequality that we have in this country? Yes, you know, millions of jobs have been created, but as we know, many of them are not high-paying jobs. Does he bear some responsibility for the state of the economy?
Well, I think if you look at what he talked about, he wants to bear some responsibility for one of the things that he apologized for, really, was his promise in 2008 that he would bring civility to the Capitol. I think he wants to bear some responsibility for that, but that enables him really to pivot and distinguish himself from what Republicans are offering. As far as the economy is concerned, he actually took a little bit of a victory lap last night, and he took credit for salvaging the economy, and he contrasted where we were in 2008, but then he turned and he acknowledged that there are obviously a lot of difficulties that many ordinary Americans don't feel the recovery. And that's where he started to talk about a system that benefits the 1%. That's actually a Bernie Sanders message.
Juana, do you want to weigh in on that as well? I mean, this has been a theme really since the recession, how the recovery has been uneven. Some people have obviously done better than others. And in many ways, you know, the middle class still treading water.
That's a really great point. You know, one of the things we heard from the president that I found interesting is that he acknowledged that there are so many Americans out there that feel frightened and shut out of this political and economic system that they see as rigged against their interests, to the point that that's a line that you hear from Elizabeth Warren, the senator as well, who speaks to out of the hopes of many progressives in America. You didn't hear Obama really take responsibility for that. I think that the economy was one of the points that he was really looking to highlight as a victory of his, by contrast of Republicans who have said that it's in complete and total decline.
But what's interesting, and I think that the president having to sort of tread between these various forces, which is there are some fears and concerns out there among the public. Clearly, the Republicans are trading on some of those fears. And I'm looking at you, Matt. But the president trying to reframe some of that.
Well, that's right. I mean, what the Republicans are doing is they're playing to middle class anxiety, which is quite real. And as a result of that, the message tends to be more negative. And what the president needs to do, and what I think he tried to do last night, is contrast that with a message that's more positive, that acknowledges the problem, that offers a pathway forward, a solution or a possible solution. And that allows him then to strike a much higher note and to attempt to rally the country.
One thing that I thought was interestingly missing, and apparently, Juana, there was a missing seat next to the First Lady, Michelle Obama, representing all the gun deaths in this country, and yet the president paid almost no attention to that issue. What do you make of that?
Marty, it was one of the most interesting things about the speech to me, is particularly in light of the very emotional, even tearful speech the president gave just a few days ago when he was unveiling his executive action on guns. The fact that he did not talk about his agenda to change nation's gun laws, to expand background checks in hopes of ending the number of gun deaths that we have in this country each year. That was totally absent. And I think it speaks to something we touched on earlier, which is the fact that legislatively, that would be a very difficult needle to thread. Some of the things that Obama would like to do when it comes to gun control would have to go through the Republican-controlled Congress and, quite frankly, stand no chance. So perhaps an acknowledgement of that. Again, he didn't gesture to that empty seat in the First Lady's box that was for victims of gun violence. So it'll be interesting to see whether or not Obama will continue to step up his rhetoric around that issue. If the State of the Union is any indication, it looks like perhaps it will not be something he continues to talk about as forcefully, but that remains to be seen.
But is that, Juana, because he has used some of these executive actions? He's sort of done what he can do on this issue so far?
I mean, it certainly could be to that point. Obama has done essentially the executive actions that he has taken on guns are the farthest that he can go without invoking Congress, without using them, without having to bring these measures for a vote. And this was a non-traditional speech in which he didn't lay out legislative priorities and instead took a thematic, emotional, and perhaps even moral approach. But I do think that the president has spoken in the past about guns as one of the great moral issues of our time, especially in the wake of Sandy Hook, for example, in the wake of the shooting we saw late last summer in Charleston. So I was still a little taken by the fact that it didn't really pop up at all. I think he said the word guns once, according to the prepared text that we reviewed.
You're nodding your head, Matt.
Yeah, I agree. I was a little surprised that it was missing from the speech, largely because of the way the president has spoken about guns quite emotionally in the last few days. It's possible that that may be the reason why it was missing, that there has been so much attention drawn to the issue, and this speech was meant to be a broader speech, a larger speech. And it was pretty clear that anything he said about guns was going to be received poorly in the House by Republicans. And so it's possible that it was just a strategic decision to leave it out.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about, frankly, what a lot of people are talking about today, which is President Obama's final State of the Union address, airing, of course, last night. Talking with Matt Kribel, a professor chair of the Political Science Department at Villanova University. Juana Summers joining us from Washington, D.C., a political editor at Mashable. She previously served as congressional reporter for NPR. 1-888-477-9499. We've got emails coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Juana Summers and also Matt Kribel about President Obama's final State of the Union address. And we'd be curious about your response if you watched it, even if you didn't watch it. Your response, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. This is something that was mentioned earlier, but it didn't make the clip for whatever reason. The president said too many people feel very frustrated with our political system. And he went on to say, it's one of the few regrets of my presidency that the rancor and suspicion between the parties has gotten worse instead of better. Juana, this is something that he also told, I forget the name, one of those morning TV talk show people yesterday as well. That seems to be an enduring regret that the president wasn't able to sort of heal this divide between the parties.
You're absolutely right. And I think the TV interview you were talking to, he was on the Today Show with Matt Lauer and talked about that in the morning.
Thank you.
It seems to be one of the lasting disappointments of his presidency. You know, President Obama campaigned on hope and change. It's what's captivated so many Americans is that he felt like a person who would actually transform Washington and politics itself. And to hear him admit not once but twice yesterday, you know, he failed. He fell far short of that goal as we look at one of the most divisive, rancorous political campaigns I've seen in a long time is really, really striking to me. And I'll be interested to watch how the president's rhetoric evolves on that or what he sees as the prescription for healing some of the divides that we feel really deeply here in Washington and that are now playing out in town halls and campaign rallies across the country.
I mean, it is interesting, Matt, this sort of disconnect between, broadly speaking, how the public feels about certain things and what happens in Washington. How do you see that?
Well, I think that's right. And I think we've seen that as the campaign has begun to play out, where there's a lot of frustration. And we see it expressed on the right and on the left. We see a kind of populist sentiment that's on the right channeled through Donald Trump primarily. On the left, we see a channel through Bernie Sanders' campaign. They're quite different. They would have quite different solutions to the problem. If they share anything, it's the sense that they don't trust the folks who were in that chamber last night. They don't trust elected officials. They don't trust the system in general. They feel it's
really against them. Do they trust the president?
Well, some of them do, some of them don't. Exactly. And we've seen that in his approval ratings, which tend to be split fairly well down the middle. And there seems to be very little room for movement either way. People are dug in.
You know, one, I thought it was interesting that the president talked about gerrymandering. I mean, the idea of sort of of changing the system so that people are not sort of people, meaning members of Congress, are not guaranteed an election. And there was a pretty loud applause line for that. And I thought, really? You really want to change the system so that you actually have to run against somebody?
Right. I remember, I think it was Ryan Lizza of The New Yorker who made the point of, if you look back to Obama's own Illinois district, there may have been a little gerrymandering in play there, too. It's a topic that does resonate with people, particularly on the left, though, who feel like the political system and their votes don't matter, that this is a deck stacked against them, that everything is rigged and corrupts. They think that Washington is more House of Cards than anything else. So if there is any movement on gerrymandering, frankly, I will be absolutely shocked. But it was refreshing and, frankly, a bit amusing to hear it as a huge applause line in the State of the Union.
Go ahead,
and
Matt.
I think this is another place where it was a progressive vision, because the president was talking about reforming the gerrymander. He was talking about getting people to vote. He spoke a lot about participation. And I think these are ideas, especially on the left, where there's the sense that Republicans are attempting to suppress the vote, that they rely on a gerrymander in order to maintain their majority in Congress. So the president wasn't afraid to really approach those issues from, you know, what could be considered a partisan standpoint.
Well, and what he seemed to be saying, and maybe I don't know if he was just speaking to the Democrats who were watching or listening, or to all people, but he said to the public or the viewing audience, the listening audience, you know, you have a responsibility here. You need to get active. You need to go out and vote.
That's right. I think he was speaking to anybody who was still tuning him in. And so I would imagine that that's probably more Democratic partisans than not. But absolutely. And it was a really interesting call to civic engagement. It's something that you don't normally expect in a State of the Union address.
Right. I'm sorry.
Normally, you would expect the president to be speaking to Congress and to be offering a legislative agenda. And here at the end of the speech, he's speaking to the public directly.
If I can for a second.
Please,
I think I think that you saw that, though, in the White House's entire strategy with how they approached this speech, that they wanted the public to tune in, that this is one of the rare opportunities, probably this and the Democratic convention this summer, that the president is going to have to forcefully address the American people with this kind of attention level. You saw it with them unveiling that they were going to join Snapchat. They released the text of the State of the Union, not first to reporters, but on Medium, so that the public could access it. Hours before the State of the Union, you saw the president get on his Facebook page and invite people to tune in. This State of the Union was all about outreach and bypassing the traditional media to reach voters in their living rooms and in their cars and really get them involved and engaged. I think Congress in the speech, frankly, was an afterthought.
Oh, interesting. I mean, was it a message to Democrats, vote, go to the polls and vote? And we know that Democrats don't vote in the kind of certainly in the primary one of the way a lot of Republicans do.
I think that there is certainly some fear among Democrats that there will be some inevitability seen in this election, that they won't turn out to vote in the primaries, that we could see that the large record numbers of folks that we saw come out and vote for Obama in 2008 and 2012 generals, that that might perhaps dissipate, handing the election over to Republicans. I think Obama's White House and the Democratic Party establishment realizes that and just how critical it is to boost that turnout.
I'd just like to second what Juana just said. I think that's exactly right. And I think if you look at the way this election is shaping up, it looks to be, for the third cycle in a row, a base election in which base turnout is extremely important. And we've seen a great deal of energy on the Republican side. I think the president was speaking to his base. And he was saying, you know, if you want this vision, if you want to make this vision possible, then you have to get out and vote.
And do you think, assuming, Sanders was there, I'm sure Clinton was watching, do you think this was a race, and O'Malley as well, think it was a race that made them happy, Matt?
I think that they would all have to be happy with the vision that Obama laid out in the speech, absolutely, because it's a vision that really any one of them could run on. He was talking about themes that you've heard come up on the Democratic side in the primary so far. Mm-hmm. So yes, I think so. And I think it also signaled the president's intention to be out there making these points and basically playing this as background music to the campaign.
And Juana, what's been the response from some of the Republican candidates to the speech?
Go ahead. As you would expect, they certainly are not pleased. I think one of the funniest responses I saw was Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, who's been lagging in the polls, tweeted in the middle of the speech, said that he would have pulled a Joe Wilson and yelled, "You lie," during the speech.
Wow.
Unfortunately, he chose not to attend. Many of the 2016 candidates who are running for president actually didn't attend the speech. You saw Florida Senator Marco Rubio was there. Bernie Sanders, as you all noted, was there as well. Rand Paul, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, chose not to attend. Donald Trump pre-butted the State of the Union, holding his own rally in Iowa just hours before the president headed to the Capitol. There's a predictable sigh of discontent among Republicans. They're angry. They feel like the president talks a great speech, but he doesn't really back it up with substance, and they see him as completely disconnected from the way that they view America. They're all headed to a debate stage tomorrow night. I expect to hear a lot of forceful rebukes of the president's words at the State of the Union and the vision he's laid out for the America of the future.
And that's Juana Summers, political editor at Mashable, also with us Matt Kerbel, chair of the political science department at Villanova University, talking about the president's speech last night. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Speaking of the Republicans, I do want to play just a small section of the GOP response. And this, of course, South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. She gave the Republican response to the State of the Union. And let's listen just to a portion of it.
Growing up in the rural South, my family didn't look like our neighbors, and we didn't have much. There were times that were tough, but we had each other. And we had the opportunity to do anything, to be anything, as long as we were willing to work for it. My story is really not much different from millions of other Americans. Immigrants have been coming to our shores for generations to live the dream that is America. They wanted better for their children than for themselves. That remains the dream of all of us. And in this country, we have seen time and again that dream is achievable. Today, we live in a time of threats like few others in recent memory. During anxious times, it can be tempting to follow the siren call of the angriest voices. We must resist that temptation.
Matt, let me go to you. First of all, it's often a difficult job for the person, whoever it is, to follow a president who gets all that pomp and circumstance.
It's virtually impossible. She did pretty well. I mean, it's really impossible to look the equal to the president, because the optics of the State of the Union address given in front of a joint session of Congress, there's really no way to equal that. What I thought was notable about the speech, and in the clip that you just played, the siren, she speaks of the siren call of the angriest voices and how you have to watch out, and guard against those. She's speaking about Donald Trump. So what I thought was interesting here is that while she did what we traditionally see in a State of the Union response, and she rebutted what the president had to say, but she was also very clearly making a reference to what's going on in the Republican Party right now in this division that we see between those voters in the base who are angry at the Republican elites, the Republican establishment, and those in the establishment who fear some of what they're hearing from candidates who appeal to that base. So it was interesting that as you said earlier, there were veiled references to Trump in the State of the Union address, but there were also these references to him in the response.
Sounds like another subtweet, Juana.
I just remember listening to Nikki Haley last night. I felt like we were talking about three different parties in the United States, not two. Her rhetoric is so different from what I've been hearing as I've traveled across the country attending events with some of these other Republican candidates. And the language she used in that clip you just played about the sirens is so similar to something Obama said in his own speech when he said, you know, our public life withers when only the most extreme voices get attention. Nikki Haley has been on the morning talk shows today, and she hasn't really shied away from the forceful criticism she's been getting from many in the far right of her own party who say that her comments weren't helpful. Ann Coulter, well-known conservative, said that Trump should deport Nikki Haley.
Oh, my God.
So she's certainly gotten some withering criticism. I think that probably she's not going to show up on Donald Trump's shortlist for a vice presidential candidate anytime soon. But I think that a lot of people are going to be giving her a second look. Nikki Haley had a great year last year as the Confederate flag came down in South Carolina. I think people are going to be talking about her role in this race quite a bit more over the next few weeks.
And Juana, who writes you know, whoever gives the response to the State of the Union, is that written by the party? Is it written by, in this case, Nikki Haley? I'm assuming the party has to kind of sign off on what she, whoever the party is, has to sign off on whatever they're going to say.
I'm assuming the party certainly has a hand in that. And to that point, we saw Reince Priebus, the chairman of the RNC, congratulate Nikki Haley on Twitter for delivering a powerful response to the State of the Union. But I'm not quite clear on the details of who writes it each time. I can't see a Nikki Haley giving up full control of a speech like that, though. She's certainly a power player in her own right.
And the first woman, the first minority to be the governor of South Carolina. A lot of firsts for her. Anything you want to add to that, Matt? And then we'll get to some callers and a lot of comments here as well.
I think Juana's observation that it's almost as if we have three parties in this country is right on the mark. And I think that's really the best way to understand what's happening right now in the Republican primary field, because it's not unusual for a party to be divided going into a nomination process. But what we see here really are two wings of the same party that want diametrically opposed things. And I think that the challenge for Republicans as they go forward is going to be to figure out a way to reconcile those differences, because ultimately one of these candidates is going to be nominated. And I think that regardless of who it is, Republicans are going to have to figure out a way to bring together two groups, two factions that are operating almost as independent parties.
And you see her as that middle person who sort of either could bring them together or represents this middle ground?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think if you look at the response that you've seen in the wake of what she said from some of the voices on the far right, it's really difficult to imagine that you know, if her speech last night wasn't well received, then it's difficult to imagine that her message is going to be well received. So it's not really clear to me right now that there is anybody who can play that role.
Let me see what Amy from West Philadelphia has to say. Amy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I noticed in the State of the Union address a distinct lack of wording that speaks to a Christian viewpoint. It was more of an appeal to a secular humanist moral, which is kind of a bold, unusual choice when addressing America at large. But, for example, speaking on our treatment of Muslims in the media and as people, he said, it diminishes us in the eyes of the world, not diminishes us before God. Do you think that was intentional? Do you think it creates distance with the average voter? I just wanted to see what you or your guests or listeners thought about that.
I mean, it's an interesting point. Juana, what do you think?
You know, first of all, I should start with saying that obviously, the president has spoken movingly about his faith in any number of forums, and he has said he is a Christian. I do think that listening to the language with which he addresses religion is always really interesting with this president. I'm not sure that I think that there was an intentional snub or, you know, a disconnect there, but there has been so much attention on anti-Muslim rhetoric given the height of the presidential campaign, and particularly in the wakes of the attacks in Paris and in San Bernardino, California, that I think that he really wanted to capitalize on, not capitalize, but to really address that forcefully, given the tone that we've seen in the Republican race.
He did. And thank you. God bless you. And God bless the United States of America. Matt, your thoughts?
He always ends that way. Sure.
Yes.
But I mean, I think that the language was designed, again, to appeal to the Democratic base. And I think, again, if you look at this as one of the opening salvos of the general election campaign, and if you think of the general election campaign as being a turnout election, then I think the president spoke in language that would resonate with the voters that he's looking to mobilize.
A bunch of emails here. Email from Mike: Obama did not promise to do anything other than try. All attempts at civility and bipartisanship were slapped away by the GOP, starting with Mitch McConnell. There's some history there. Do you want to weigh in on that?
There is certainly some history there. I think that if I could name the top thing that President Obama won't miss, it is probably the Republican-controlled Congress. They have been nothing but a roadblock for his agenda. You've heard Obama come out time and time again and talk about his frustrations with negotiating with Republicans here on Capitol Hill. He's not been able to get through his legislative items. People have called them the party of no. So there's quite a lengthy bit of history there. So to the caller's point.
Well, and you do hear, Matt, from the other side, Republicans complaining. He never invites us to the White House. He's not interested in talking to us or inviting us into the conversation.
You do hear that. We've been hearing that for 7 years.
We have.
And we've also been hearing the president for 7 years say, I'm open to your suggestions. I want to work with you. That's basically been the narrative of gridlock, if you will. I think this speaks to why you didn't have a laundry list of proposals. This is a president entering his eighth year. And I think he's seeking relevance, and he understands that given the nature of Congress, the best way to be relevant is to try at this point to soar above the details. And I think that's what he intends to try to do going forward.
That's Matt Kerbel, again, professor and chair of the Political Science Department at Villanova University, just outside of Philadelphia. Juana Summers joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. She was congressional reporter for NPR, and she's currently political editor at Mashable. 1-888-477-9499. A bunch of emails, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Juana Summers and Matt Kerbel about the president's State of the Union address last night. Also, the response from South Carolina Governor Republican Nikki Haley. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Matt and I were talking during the break about just the body language. I always find that so weirdly interesting, just to see how people are looking as the president is speaking. Who jumps up? Who jumps down?
Yeah,
who applauds? Who doesn't?
It can be uncomfortable if you have to make a decision whether to get up and applaud finding a cure for cancer.
Yeah, what do you do about that, right?
Yeah, I mean, what do you do about that? I mean, if on the one hand you want to signal to your voters that you really don't respect this president, that you believe that he's all talk and no action, that you don't like the things he stands for, then the last thing you want to do is get up and applaud. And, I think that was most evident with Speaker Ryan, who was on camera the whole time and just had to sit there.
Yeah. Well, and I thought it was interesting. One, I don't want to read too much. I don't read lips very well. But when the president talked about curing cancer and turning to Joe Biden, of course, we know about his son's struggle with cancer. It looked like Joe Biden said, "I didn't know that," or some version of that. I had no idea he was going to say that.
It's that was a very, very funny moment. I think we have a GIF of it on our website, and it was just kind of funny. I couldn't quite tell what he said. It looked like that may have been what he said, but then of course, Vice President Biden dropped his own piece on Medium talking about the initiative that the president was going to announce that night. So if he didn't know he was going to say that, he certainly have seemed pretty well prepared for that moment.
And, you know, if there were those sort of thought bubbles coming out, anything to read from the faces behind the president?
Paul Ryan looked like he was ready to go home or go back to his P90X for most of the speech. I don't think that he's quite perfected. He said in some interviews ahead of the State of the Union that he'd been planning to practice his poker face for having the seat behind Obama and being constantly in the camera's eye. Not sure he quite mastered that one.
unfortunately. But it's a hard spot to be in. I certainly would not want to be on camera behind the President of the United States for an hour of a speech. So I commend them for trying.
You commend them as well, Matt?
You have to.
You have to. It's a difficult job.
It's a difficult job.
Let me see what Peter from Lumberton has to say. Peter, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Love the program.
Thank you.
Have several comments to make. I was really disappointed last night that the president was sort of apologizing for not getting along with Congress. It wasn't because he didn't want to. They said it from the first day that they had Mitch McConnell wanted to make him a one-term president. And considering all the accomplishments that he's done in these 7 years, with absolutely no help, I think he's done a great job as president. We'll be sorry to let him go. And my last comment is it odd, or has anybody else picked this up, but there were three people who were not there last night who never show up to his State of the Union addresses for the last several years, and that was Scalia, Alito, and Thomas. Roberts was there, and Kennedy was there, but the other three never show up. And I just think that's a very disrespectful thing not to show year after year to the State of the Union address. And that goes to the divide that there is on the Supreme Court, which is not supposed to be political, in my opinion.
Well, Peter, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I do remember a couple of years ago when the president criticized the Supreme Court for Citizens United. Alito was there. I'm looking at you, Matt. And he did not like what the president said.
You could read his lips on that occasion. And it was very clear he did not agree with what the president said. Yes.
And is there a reason, Juana, that Scalia, Alito, and Thomas weren't there or haven't been there in the past?
You know, I can't speak for the other two, but to the caller's point, I do remember Scalia speaking at an event in Washington a couple years back. He said that he doesn't go no matter if the president's a Democrat or a Republican. He thinks that it's a childish spectacle that he didn't want to lend any dignity to. He absolutely hates it and hasn't been particularly shy about that. So there's an answer there. Not quite sure what the motivations are for the other two, though, or whether or not they fall along the same partisan lines.
And what about the idea? Peter said he felt like the president was apologizing for the dysfunction in Congress. And from his perspective, from Peter's perspective, he didn't need to do that, Matt.
Yeah, I think that you would also find quite a few of the president's supporters would agree with Peter on that point. But again, you would also find quite a few of his detractors taking a different point of view. So, and I think in that respect, it really does speak to the partisan divide and where you happen to stand.
Let me read an email from Anna. I'm not sure I can get through the whole thing here, but she says, I assume that the president largely omitted talking about gun control was that it has become an issue between the two chief Democratic candidates for the presidential nomination, and he didn't want to interfere in that race. Now, we can't get in the head of the president, Juana, but what do you think about that idea?
That is a really fascinating point. As gun control, as this email correctly notes, has become one of the biggest battlegrounds for Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. Just last night, Hillary Clinton released a new ad that pointed to some of what she and many Democrats see as missteps in Senate votes that Bernie Sanders has made on guns, particularly on the issue of immunity for gun makers. It is a huge issue in the Democratic race, and both candidates have been really pulling every punch they can to try to prove who's right on this issue. And that is definitely a tricky point for a president who is not likely to endorse one of the Democratic candidates this primary season. It puts him in a tough place. Mm. So maybe perhaps this email is onto something.
But not, I mean, wouldn't endorse until whoever the voters pick, whoever the candidate is. I mean, is that sort of what presidents do, Juana?
That's sort of what presidents do, and that's what the Obama White House has said he will do. Earlier, maybe a couple months ago, there was some back and forth with White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest over whether or not Obama would, in fact, endorse. The White House has said pretty forcefully, though, recently, as this race on the Democratic side remains really close, that he's not going to be making a pick between Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and, of course, Martin O'Malley.
And of course, Martin O'Malley. Yeah, go
yes,
ahead.
Martin O'Malley. I think Anna's point is quite perceptive. You know, if you look at this speech as a blueprint for the general election campaign, then it's certainly the case that at least where things stand now, taking a very specific position on guns might undermine the ability or Obama's ability to spell out a vision or present a vision that that any of the candidates can run on, because I think it is the case that on gun control, that's maybe the only place where Hillary Clinton can go after Bernie Sanders from his left and outflank him on the left, because as a senator from Vermont, he has at times voted against gun control measures. And given that the Sanders campaign is in general, Sanders is running a campaign to the left of Hillary Clinton, guns have become a big issue between them.
We haven't really talked about any of the foreign policy challenges facing the country, frankly, facing the world. Juana, sort of broadly speaking, I mean, the president said we're the most powerful country in the world. We spend more money on the military, I think, than the top, five, six, seven countries. But it is interesting that even the most powerful country in the world can't necessarily boss the world around anymore.
That's true. When I was listening to the foreign policy sections of the speech, it was yet another area where I felt like the president was really trying to draw broadly a rhetorical contrast with Republicans. You also heard him say that it's incorrect to say that this is World War III, which is something that you've heard New Jersey Governor Chris Christie say when he's referring to things. He also made allusions to Ted Cruz's comments about carpet bombing the so-called Islamic State or ISIS. I believe he said that that makes for a really great TV soundbite, but when it comes to actually leading the world and leading the country, doesn't quite work out that way. So you've heard there was a lot of rhetoric there. You didn't hear Obama say anything new, of course, about how he would combat ISIS or what he would do to keep American space safe, though we have heard him talk recently about the terrorist threats this country faces, certainly, and about our engagement on the world stage. You also heard him speak about not being able to close off the country, not being able to get into isolationism. Again, I think this speech, if I could give it one theme, it was about contrast, and you certainly heard that when you talk about American foreign policy.
And he kind of framed it, Matt, which is, you know, that we have a role to play, but we cannot be the world's policeman.
Yes, that's exactly what he said. I think he was attempting to appeal to people's better instincts, if you will, in the sense that there has been a lot of fear. And there's been a lot of, in the Republican campaign certainly, there has been an appeal in a sense to things that are genuinely frightening. So how do you deal with that politically? One way is to in fact play to people's concerns, to their fears, and to say you really need to support a candidate who's going to keep you safe. The other way is to appeal to people's hopes. And to say, we're a great nation, we're a strong nation, we have a history of standing up to threats, that while we face threats that are real, we faced bigger threats in the past. So I think rhetorically, and I think Juan is absolutely right about this, rhetorically he's drawing a contrast to what we've been hearing in the Republican campaign. And I think he's again offering that for whoever the Democratic nominee may be, offering it as a theme for them to carry forward.
And he did mention Cuba, certainly normalizing relations with Cuba. And what was interesting, at least at this time, Juana, is that he did make a reference to Iran. They apparently have been released as of this morning. But while he was speaking, there were Americans being held in Iran.
That's absolutely right. And this is something that as we were watching conversations on cable news and on social media, that the president got quite a bit of flack for, of not tweaking the language in the State of the Union to more forcefully address that. I heard from a lot of Republicans and Democrats, frankly, who think that was a huge mistake on the president's part and that he should have said something about that in the State of the Union. Again, the speech wasn't really about things that were happening in the moment. It was very forward looking, but I think that there's certainly a lot of people who wanted to hear him talk about these sailors who were being detained literally as he spoke.
I mean, just acknowledging the fact that, you know, while I am talking to you, this is going on halfway around the world.
Right, exactly. And I have to admit, I'm a little shocked that they didn't change course and acknowledge that given the gravity of the situation. Of course, there may have also been strategic reasons for not doing so. And obviously, I don't get a daily intelligence briefing every day, so I wouldn't know what those are. But I think that that might have been a calculated move by the White House.
Interestingly, the president said, I do get a intelligence briefing every day. Sort of saying, I know this is a dangerous world that we live in. Let me get Thomas from Wilmington to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Thomas. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. Hi, Marty.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Nice show. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks.
I just wanted really quickly to mention something about the Republican response, but rather quickly because I know we are short of time here. I really think that the president avoided the top issues that are very divisive, especially gun control issues, Guantanamo Bay, and immigration issues, which I think, seriously, when he starts going around the country, going to be probably be talking about them more. But I think more or less he was talking about trying to be reconciliatory, now that really has nothing to show, and he wants to go and build his legacy. Anyway, going back to the Republican response.
Yes.
The Republican response was rather good. It was rather reconciliatory as well. But I think governor of South Carolina, I think she has ambitions probably down the road, and she doesn't want to be aligned with the extremists in the Republican Party. So she was rather trying to lie in the middle. Remember, this lady has been also known to be converted to Christianity. But at the same time, she actually kind of practices her parents' religion. So there has been a lot of...
you know what, Thomas? Let me take your point.
Way. So sure. I don't know what your guests think about.
Well, let me take your question and your point, which is that does Nikki Haley have political ambitions? One would assume, Matt Kerbel, that she probably does.
One would assume that if she's giving the response to the State of the Union address, she does have political ambitions. And I think she's looking at the divide in the Republican Party. I think it was fairly clear from her actions recently when she ordered the Confederate flag removed from the South Carolina State House that she is going to align herself with more traditional Republicans, with more establishment Republicans, which is interesting because she did come up as a Tea Party candidate originally. But yes, I would suspect that that she does have political ambitions, and that what she spoke about last night was as much as anything an opportunity for her to have a national audience and to introduce herself to the American people and her story.
You know, a couple minutes before we have to say goodbye, going back to you, Juana, the president did talk about the need to close Guantanamo Bay. In fact, when he was first elected, I think his very first State of the Union, he said that was his top priority, the first thing he was going to do in office. And of course, Guantanamo Bay is still open, not as many people there as in the past. But what is the chance in the next, 11 months or something like that is going to happen?
I think it's probably slim to none. This is a tough one for the president because he really needs Congress to go along with him here. And just about every year that I've been covering Capitol Hill and the annual defense policy bill, Congress includes language that would make it very difficult, if not impossible, for the president to close the doors of that military prison. And the president, as he did last year, just a couple months ago, signed that defense policy bill again because it's the bill that authorizes the funds for our nation's troops. And it would put the president in quite a tenuous position if he were to not sign that bill. So he kind of has to go along with the fact that this is one that probably isn't going to happen for him, despite the fact that he's been pushing for it for 7 years now.
Yeah, 7 years now, Matt.
Yeah, no, I think this one gets passed along to the next administration.
And it's not like the Democrats have really helped him on trying to close Guantanamo Bay, as I understand it. I mean, no one is saying, you know, come to our state.
That's exactly right. Right. And because when you look at this at the state level, people, Democrats as well as Republicans have pushed back.
Well, it's going to be a really interesting year. And my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Juana Summers, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And she's political editor at Mashable. She previously served as congressional reporter for NPR, if her voice sounded familiar to you. And in 2012, she covered the presidential election for Politico. Matt Kerbel, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, Marty.
You're very welcome. Professor Chair of the Political Science Department at Villanova University. He's got a new book coming out this year called Next Generation Netroots, Realignment and the Rise of the Internet Left. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for a newsletter, check us out on the archives, and you can also listen to us on satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.